Welcome to Mythic Imagination. I'm Honora Foa. Tonight, we'll share with you the final podcast in our three-part series, War, Peace, and the American Imagination. These podcasts were based on a conversation between James Hillman and Deepak Chopra, moderated by Jean Houston. In these conversations, Dr. Houston, a renowned philosopher, mythologist, and the author of A Mythic Life, reminds us that, quote, we are preparing ourselves to ride the wild waves of the most exciting, if dangerous, time in human history. Dr. Hillman, the author of A Terrible Love of War, says that unless we face our own love of aggression, war, glory, danger and destruction, and see ourselves as beings with many sides, one of which is a lover of a powerful God who has periodically held humankind in thrall for all of our history, we will be full of the illusion that allows us to be overcome again and again by this God because we do not acknowledge his existence or our attraction to him. We tell ourselves elaborate lies, trying to justify the god-awful things we do rather than admitting that old black magic has us in its spell again. And what should we do about it? Jeanette Rankin parallels this thought about the magnitude of the forces behind war when she writes, "You can no more win a war than you can win an earthquake." Dr. Hillman worries that perhaps Plato is right when he says, "It is only the dead who have seen the end of war." In tonight's podcast, Dr. Chopra, the author of Peace is the Way, expresses his belief that it is possible for individuals to transform their consciousness such that we can bring an end to war. But will we? And will we do it in time? All three of our presenters seem to concur with former President John Kennedy, who said, "Mankind must put an end to war before war puts an end to mankind." With this in mind, let's listen to Deepak Chopra as he shares his take on war, peace, and the American imagination.
Because I thought I was here to disagree and debate Dr. Hillman, and I have no disagreement with what he says, that war offers sublimation, violence offers many purposes, it serves theological purposes, it is entertainment, it is economics, it is eroticism, it is empowerment, it is morality, it is rationality, for we are going there killing the Iraqis so we can give them freedom. It is ritual, it is coming of age, it is the rite of passage, it is a psychological transformation, it is a power of intoxicating kind. So it's very seductive. There's no question about it. That's the archetypal, mythical explanation, that we have Mars inside us, and Mars is betrothed to Venus, and you can't have romance, you can't have eroticism, you can't have seduction, you can't even have sensuality unless it is part of our violent nature. So there's no disagreement. That's the good psychological, very deep understanding of mythic archetypes and how these invisible forces govern our very being. From a biological standpoint also, violence has its role. You know, the planet is only 3.8 billion years old. The universe is about 14 billion years old. Human beings have been around for only 200,000 years. Of those 200,000 years, maybe the last 10,000 years, we have had some kind of awareness. Written language is about 6,000 years old. Oral language a little longer than that. And self-awareness perhaps goes back 5,000 years at most, you know, to the time of the axial sages, the sages of the Upanishads in India and the Greek philosophers and Lao Tzu and Confucius in the East, the emergence of axial wisdom around about 5,000 years. So if you were to say the history of the planet is started on January 1, then about June 1, the first life forms appeared. On December 31st, human beings showed up. About 15 minutes ago, human beings learned to communicate verbally and through written language. Self-awareness is about 5 minutes ago. And the internet and modern forms of communication, including modern warfare, is about half a minute ago. So I think we can be very forgiving if we want to be. We haven't yet reached puberty. We are not even in our infancy. But the problem is that this kind of past, and there has never been, as Dr. Hillman said, there's never been a time. We have very romantic notions about ancient past traditions. You know, we say, oh, the Greeks were very civilized, because when we think of the Greeks, we think of Parmenides and Socrates and Plato and Pythagoras. But the vast majority of Greeks at that time were sexist. They were barbarians. They believed in slavery. They had all kinds of rituals that were savage. We think of India and we think of the sages of the Upanishads, but we tend to romanticize based on these few luminaries. The history of human beings, the history of civilization, has been the history of violence and the history of predation. Biologically, by the way, this response, which is controlled by that part of our brain, which is called the limbic brain, is known as the fight-flight response. When I was in medical school, the way we remembered the functions of the limbic system were the four Fs: feeding, fighting, fleeing, and procreation. And so we became good at it. And we became so good at it that right now we are the predator on this planet. And there is some wisdom in the saying that a permanently victorious species risks its own extinction. A permanently victorious species risks its own extinction. And that's where we are. If you could look at this planet from some vantage point in outer space and you were to ask yourself, who's the most dangerous animal? If this planet is a living organism, then what's the cancer? And the cancer is Homo sapiens, metastasizing, multiplying, gouging, plundering, destroying the ecosystem. The problem with that, even though it's all true, is that when you combine this ancient way of living, this ancient tribal, atavistic, primordial aspect of human nature, and you combine it with modern capacities, then the outlook is very, very bleak right now. I would disagree in one aspect with Dr. Hillman, that there is lack of imagination. I think we have tremendous imagination. But our imagination serves diabolical purposes. I was just reading the other day that there is now technology to create a neutron bomb. And if you dropped it on a city, it would be seeking human temperature. And what that would result is in a complete vaporization of human beings through radiation. Every other living species would be spared. Only human beings would disappear. Even your clothes would remain intact. You could walk into a city and it would be totally intact, except there would be no human beings. My God, that is imagination. I'm reading of technologies that say that in about 10 years from now, we won't even need these neutron bombs. We won't even need these biological weapons. We could have something like a simple handheld computer, like my little Trio. We would move electrons here and interfere with air traffic signals and hijack not one plane, but all the planes. that we would be able to cut off the electricity in a city like Atlanta and suffocate it, interfere with air transportation systems, poison the food chain, cause nuclear plants to leak and wreak havoc, enter the food chain with things like depleted uranium and cause malformations for generations to come. This is not lack of imagination. This is imagination that actually spells doom for our planet and for the extinction of all species and the extinction of our own species. And imagination will do it. I was talking to an anthropologist friend of mine, and he said that if imagines, and maybe in the universe's imagination, the thought came, you know, human beings, they were an interesting species, didn't work. Was a good experiment, didn't work. And so be done with it and move on. And it wouldn't make a bit of a difference to nature. Wouldn't make a bit of a difference to the magnificence and awesome mystery of the universe. After all, we are a speck of dust in a huge void. In our self-importance, we may think we are more than that, but you know, from nature's vantage point, get rid of this species, the cancer on the planet. But there's another aspect to our imagination also. And I think the imagination is not lacking, it's the sense of self that's lacking. If we could answer one question and understand what our real identity is, then perhaps the same imagination, which is diabolical at this moment, could find a new creativity, a new inspiration, a new insight, a new imagination that would, for the first time in recorded history, we cannot go by the example of recorded history, but for the first time, we could understand that the universe is becoming self-conscious through us. We are the only species that has a nervous system that is aware that we are aware. The only species that is conscious that we are conscious. And now we are beginning, at least some people in the world are beginning to understand that consciousness is the ground of being. It's the raw material that differentiates into biological organisms, into environments, into behaviors, into cognition, into perception, into emotions, into social interactions, into personal relationships, and into the web of creation that we call the ecosystem. And in that self-awareness, perhaps lies our salvation. I have imagined for you the diabolical aspects of human creativity and human imagination. But perhaps we could imagine the divine aspects of human creativity also, because the human soul is a place of ambiguity. It has the sacred, it has the profane, it has the divine, it has the diabolical, it has forbidden lust, but it also has love and compassion and understanding and beauty and intuition and nurturing and tenderness and the possibility to evolving into a new species altogether. So we have the fight-flight response within us, but we have something called the reactive response. We have something called the restful awareness response. We have something called the intuitive response, which is a form of intelligence that is contextual and relational and holistic and nurturing and doesn't have a win-lose orientation, that sees the interdependent co-arising of form and phenomena in the entire universe. We have the creative response, which is the ability to create something that never existed before. We have the visionary response, which says, in Martin Luther King's words, I have a dream, and we know immediately it's not a personal dream, but a collective dream, an archetypal dream seeking freedom and creativity and liberation, not for one person, but for an entire humanity. And then we have something called the sacred response. The sacred response is waking up to the luminous mystery in which we are bathed. The fact that we may never be able to unravel this mystery, but it certainly is a mystery. And there is no bigger human emotion, I think, than a sense of mystery, a sense of wonder, a sense of awe, a sense of feeling that we are connected with the sacred powers and the sacred source of the universe. Rumi, my favorite Sufi poet, says, "When I die, I will soar with angels. But when I die to the angels, what I shall become, you cannot imagine." Because to imagine what I shall become, you have to have the imagination of an angel. Evolutionary biologists are now telling us that evolution is not a random adaptation to environmental forces, but evolution is punctuated by periods of what are called punctuated disequilibrium, where there is the progressive proliferation of chaos, even anarchy. And within that chaotic, anarchic soup of ambiguity and confusion is the rising of a new emergent property. Nietzsche, the German philosopher, said, "When there is chaos, there is the possibility of the birth of a dancing star." I would say to you that perhaps another way of looking at our times is that we are in that phase transition. Phase transitions are recognized in natural systems. When water turns to steam, that's a phase transition. And all phase transitions are punctuated, or actually an expression of great turbulence. Right now we see that turbulence in the destruction of our ecosystem, in the wars and the terrorisms and the terrorist activities that we read about every day, in great social injustice, in economic disparities, where 8 million people die every year because they are too poor to live. We obviously don't see the relationship between, say, something like Katrina and human activity, but it's time to ask those questions. Is it time to ask questions like, does global warming have anything to do with rising tidal waves and depleted ozone layers? Does the fact that we are seeing disappearing shorelines because of us and our human activity by dams that artificially change the course of rivers, does deforestation in Asia and Africa have anything to do with changing weather patterns because there's only one atmosphere? Does the destruction of the flora and fauna have anything to do with migration of birds, with the habits of the natural habitat, with the ecosystem, which also affects weather patterns in one place, affecting them globally? No longer can we separate ourselves from nature because we are expressions of nature. And I think the great quantum leap we need to make right now with a sense of urgency is that leap in imagination, but that leap in imagination coming from a place of self that says, I'm not a skin-encapsulated ego that is squeezed into the volume of a body in the span of a lifetime, that my consciousness transcends my physical identity. And that when that consciousness reaches a critical mass, perhaps we will see an age that even Homer never dreamed of.
This concludes the Mythic Imagination podcasts of the introductory remarks from War, Peace, and the American Imagination. At the conclusion to these remarks, Hillman, Chopra, and Houston had a flowing conversation for 45 minutes where they developed and argued and imagined together why and how the imagination passionately engaged in creative response is the only way out of our terrible love of war. James Hillman wrote another book called The Soul's Code, which was about the critical importance of each individual soul living out its own true nature. As each thing and each being unfolds, most fully as itself, the full potential of the world begins to manifest. Joseph Campbell's famous quote, "Follow your bliss," though sometimes superficially understood, means exactly and only this, to obey the law of your own true self. The cosmic consciousness Chopra is speaking of is not the same as groupthink. It is a joining of true minds, of individuals living out of their own true meaning and purpose. It becomes more possible to consider the reality of other people, other creatures, other needs, when we are deeply grounded in our own reality. Here is a story by Hazrat Inayat Khan that gives a picture of the difficulties of finding one's own way, read to us by Brad Barnett.
A young lad was sent to school. He began his lessons with the other children, and the first lesson the teacher set him was the straight line, the figure one. But whereas the others went on progressing, this child continued writing the same figure. After two or three days, the teacher came up to him and said, "Have you finished your lesson?" He said, "No, I'm still writing one." He went on doing the same thing. And when at the end of the week, the teacher asked him again, he said, "I have not yet finished it." The teacher thought he was an idiot and should be sent away, as he could not or did not want to learn. At home, the child continued with the same exercise, and the parents also became tired and disgusted. He simply said, "I have not yet learned it. I am learning it. When I have finished, I shall take the other lessons." The parents said, "The other children are going on further. School has given you up, and you do not show any progress. We are tired of you." And the lad thought with sad heart that as he had displeased his parents too, he had better leave home. So he went into the wilderness and lived on fruits and nuts. After a long time, he returned to his old school. And when he saw the teacher, he said to him, "I think I have learned it. See if I have. Shall I write on this wall?" And when he made his sign, the wall split in two.
Mythic Imagination is a production of the Mythic Imagination Institute. The sound designer for Mythic Imagination is Brad Barnett. Special thanks to Creative Digital Group for the generous use of their studio. Find them on the web at creativedigitalgroup.com. The writer and producer of Mythic Imagination is Donna Barnett. Our musical introduction is by Jeffrey Armus. He can be found on the web at jeffreyarmus.com, GEOFFREYARMES. War Peace and the American Imagination was hosted in the fall of 2005 by Emory University. It was co-sponsored by the Mythic Imagination Institute and the Alliance for a New Humanity. Our sincere thanks to Deepak Chopra for sharing his inspiring insights. Please visit him on the web at www.chopra.com. For more information on the Alliance for a New Humanity, please visit them at www.anhglobal.org. To find out more about Mythic Journeys, the conference held by Mythic Imagination Institute, visit our website, mythicimagination.org. Thank you very much for listening to Mythic Imagination. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Please email us at info@mythicjourneys.org. And please join us next time for Mythic Imagination, where we will move from the topic of our terrible love of war and its archetype, Mars, to our terrible love of love and its archetype, Venus. Tonight, we will leave you with a song by Sherry Kling from her CD, Heartland. Sherry can be found on the web at www.sherrykling.com, SHERIKLING. As each individual soul looks to connect with its deepest purpose and meaning, we all have moments when the project seems to be failing, meaning eludes us, and our hearts in grief ask why. Here is Sherry's song, The Wall of Why.
So somehow. Show me how to love this life that's mine as it is. Seeing with new eyes, break me open to the light. Keep me still between shock and anger, not banging my head against the wall. Shock and anger, not banging my head, not banging my head, not banging my head against the wall.
Remember, at Mythic Imagination, every life is a story, and a story can change the world.